When do we learn in our actual experience the priority of prayer, the reality of our faith, and our utter dependency on God? When and where do we learn that? When do we learn how to really be like Christ? Surely it's when we really do take up a cross, when we do really feel the weight of the cross, where we feel the burden of the cross, where things are tough, where all other supports give way, where we are isolated, when we're alone, when the things we rely on, although we say we don't rely on them, have been taken away from us. That's when we learn the reality of faith. That's when we learn the power of prayer. That's when we learn to be like Jesus. David is a man of faith. He's demonstrated that as he killed the giant Goliath. We've seen that he's put his trust in the Lord, and he knows that the battle belongs to the Lord. He's also the anointed king, the one that God has clearly chosen to be king. But he's on the run. He's pretty humiliated in this section of these three stories we've got. He's exiled, he's pursued, he's persecuted. In fact, he kind of stays this way for about 10 years. But all that time, God preserves and God provides and God is with him. And David learns all kinds of lessons like you do when you're going through trials. And we're going to think about the beginning of that period this morning from 1 Samuel 21. First of all, let's see that the Lord is with his anointed. Let's see the presence of the Lord. And we're going to read the first 9 verses now. David went to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" David answered Ahimelech the priest, "The king charged me with a certain matter and said to me, 'No one is to know anything about your mission and your instructions. As for my men, I have told them to meet me at a certain place.' Now then, what have you to hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find." But the priest answered David, "I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women." David replied, "Indeed, women have been kept from us as usual whenever I set out. The men's things are holy or bodies are holy, even on missions that are not holy. How much more so today?" So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there except the bread of the presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day it was taken away. Now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg, the Edomite, Saul's head shepherd. David asked Ahimelech, "Don't you have a spear or a sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any other weapon because the king's business was urgent." The priest replied, "The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, is here. It is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you want it, take it. There is no sword here but that one." David said, "There is none like it. Give it to me." David on the run goes to where the priests are. The tabernacle is in another place, Kiriath-Jearim, the Ark of the Covenant is not there, but the tabernacle is probably where the priests are here. The Ark is somewhere else. It's brought back by David to Jerusalem much later on, as you'll remember. And he receives a very cautious welcome from Ahimelech. Ahimelech, in fact, trembles when he meets him. His knees are knocking. "What's going on? What are you doing? What are you doing here?" Because I'm sure Ahimelech has got wind of the fact that there is a problem between David and Saul. But David asks for food. He's a fugitive. He's running for his life. He's hungry. But the priest said the only bread that's available is the one that's been consecrated on the table before the Lord, the one that had just been replaced, as it is every Sabbath, and a new hot piece put in its place. The priests under the law were allowed to eat that. And Ahimelech, he makes some inquiries. He asks what we might call a strange question about whether the men had been with women. And that's because in Deuteronomy, it talks about sexual abstinence as being important for men on a holy war. So if they're kind of in war on behalf of the Lord, that was part of the regulation. So that's why he asked that question. David is kind of at war, although at the moment it's kind of him against the rest of Israel. And Ahimelech is satisfied with the answer that David gives, and he gives him some bread. They were literally loaves, or they were kind of flat cakes of bread, probably a number of them. Someone's watching. He's called Doeg, the Edomite. He's a baddie. He's a shepherd, chief shepherd of Saul, but he also turns out to be a spy. We'll see that next week. David asks for a sword. Don't know why the priests had this particular sword, the sword of Goliath, but they do. It's the only sword they have. They have it wrapped up as an ephod. Maybe that was a good thing. Maybe it had become a bit of a relic. I don't know, that kind of people would look, and it was considered a sacred object. I'm not sure. But they have it, and they offer it to David, and David is very pleased to see it, even though it would have been, no doubt, a really big sword. But he said there's none like it, which there probably wasn't, none quite as big as that, and takes it. Maybe he's starting to remember the victory that God had wrought, the victory that God had brought about in the defeat of Goliath. What makes David lie? He kind of pretends like he's a Jack Bauer on a sort of secret mission, on black ops. He's going dark. Most of you women won't understand a word of all that. But there he is, undercover. That's what he says anyway. Why does he lie like that? Maybe he's just desperately hungry and he does need to eat. Maybe he is just trying to protect his own life. Maybe he's trying to give Ahimelech what you might call plausible deniability, that there will be a good excuse, a good reason why he does feed David. I think we need to remember that David is both the Lord's anointed, but he's also fighting for his life. And remember that in terms of the what David says, the Bible doesn't make a comment, good or bad. So we have to make our own judgment about whether he made the right judgment in what he says. Remember that preserving life is not a trivial matter, and in a sense there's a hierarchy in that it comes above perhaps the keeping of particular arbitrary regulations. But whatever you might think about the lie, Jesus takes a very favorable view of actually what happens with the bread. We read about that in Mark's Gospel. We looked at that a few weeks ago, but it's also in Matthew's Gospel. Matthew 12, up on the screen there, from verses 3 to 8. Jesus answered when he was criticized for his disciples and perhaps him eating some grain on the Sabbath. Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that the priests on Sabbath duty in the temple desecrate the Sabbath and yet are innocent? I tell you that something greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words mean, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Jesus says David technically may have broken the regulations, but it was legitimate. Legitimate to save life, legitimate because he was the Lord's anointed. He reminds his hearers that technically the priests break the regulations because technically they're not supposed to go into this area where the bread is, but they do because they have to change the bread. So he's just making, I suppose you could say, the common sense point that has to be exercised in the working out of those regulations. But I think this is recorded for more than just a bit of a lesson about keeping the law or some things being more important than others. Just think about it. Of all the places to go, David goes to where the priests are. He's gone to Samuel before that, and now he goes to where the priests are. And of all the possible food options to him, the only one available is the bread of the presence. And of all the days that he would go there, he goes on the Sabbath, which is the very day that this bread is replaced. So stale though it might be after a week there is some bread available for him. Here's a man with nowhere to lay his head. Here's a man with virtually no friends. Here's a man with no army. He's been used to having an army because he's gone out on raids on behalf of Saul before then. Here's a man with no weapons. And he goes and he receives the bread of the presence. What is that saying? I think it's saying God is still with you, David. God is with him, and he's beginning to realize that, especially as he sees the sword and he remembers God's goodness in the past. He remembers that all that mattered when he faced Goliath was that God was with him. And so he receives the bread of the presence. Do you feel alone? Do you feel alone even in a crowd? Do you feel sometimes abandoned by everybody? Do you feel completely on your own? Do you feel moments or months or years of isolation? Jesus, as Lord of the Sabbath, as the one who had the right to interpret the law, also says that he's Lord of the Sabbath in the sense that he comes to bring rest, and he comes to bring the presence of God. The temple, something greater than the temple, is here, he says. What does he mean? He means the real presence of God is here. Even more than David receiving a token of God's presence, we as Christian believers know the presence of God in our hearts by the Holy Spirit, because Jesus has come, and Jesus has died, and Jesus has risen, and Jesus has sent the Spirit, and he is the Spirit of Christ in us. That's what we need to remember when we feel alone, when we feel abandoned, that God is always with his people. And sometimes a helpful thing when we're feeling alone, when we're feeling abandoned, when we're feeling perhaps God is not with us, when we're feeling that all the props have been taken away and we're not sure whether God is enough, it's often good to remember God's goodness in the past. And I think that's what David does as he sees the sword. Do you review God's goodness to you? We thought about that a little bit last Sunday, didn't we, as Georgia was baptized. It was a great opportunity for us to think back about our baptism, a key moment perhaps when we knew the goodness of God and the faithfulness of God. And maybe if we think about times since we were baptized, when we've really known God's answer to prayer, when we've really known God working in our lives, when we've really known just a sense of the fact that God loves us, when we've really known his power in helping us turn away from sin, when we've seen a friend or a member of our family come to faith and we've seen the power of God in their lives, it's really good to look back and review those things, to remember them and to say, yeah, God is with me. He's done so much in my life. I might not feel like it just right now, but he has. And it's great to remember that. I'm sure David Nash, as he lies in hospital, is reviewing God's goodness in the past. He's a very godly man. We were there with him, and he started singing, I know who holds the future. I know who holds the future. Give me the next line, somebody. I do not know what lies ahead, the way I cannot see, but one stands near to be my guide, he'll show the way to me. He sung that, and then he sung, I know who holds the future. It wasn't very loud, and it wasn't very tuneful, but it was extraordinarily faithful. And I think either just after that or just a few moments later, he broke into a prayer, and he prayed, you know, God, I don't know what's happening to me, but please help me. You know, here's a man who is trusting God for the future because he's seen God helping him through his life. And we want to be like that. When we feel abandoned and alone, you could feel the kind of the loneliness of David as he's there on the hospital bed. There's no one visiting him at that particular moment. You know, his family can come in and we can come in and so forth. But in hospital, you're often alone. And particularly, he'd just been down for a procedure and he'd come back up. And there's just these confusing nurses whizzing backwards and forwards. And you feel really poorly and confused. And here he is, trusting in God. And we want to be like that, saying, I know who holds the future. I review his goodness to me in the past. He is with me. He's with me right now in this particular trial. Can you say that this morning? The Lord was with his anointed king. Secondly, the Lord hears the prayer of his anointed king. David sees the trembling Ahimelech. David sees the watchful Doeg. And verse 10, he runs straight away. Let's read that. That day, David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. But the servants of Achish said to him, "Isn't this David, the king of the land? Isn't he the one they sing about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. So he feigned insanity in their presence. And while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the doors of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Achish said to his servants, "Look at the man. He is insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short of madmen that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house?" It's a real twist in the drama, isn't it? He's got Goliath's sword, and he goes, of all places, to Gath, the hometown of the giant Goliath. And there's a ruler there called Achish. It's probably, almost certainly, the same one that's called Abimelech in the psalm. Abimelech might have been a kind of generic name, a bit like Pharaoh for a sort of king. So just when you see that, when we refer to Psalm 34 in a minute, that's the same person that we're talking about. So that's Achish. It seems crazy to us that he would go there, but maybe David was reasoning like this. My enemy's enemy is my friend. So he's thinking, well, the enemy of Saul is the Philistines, so let's go to the Philistines because I'm an enemy of Saul and they're an enemy of Saul, and maybe that would be a good thing. He makes a similar decision in chapter 27, you'll see. But it's not a great decision, and he's immediately recognized. The cheerleaders theme song has been heard on the radio or whatever by the Philistines. So they know all about David. They recognize him as a king. They speak, in fact, better than they know, don't they? They refer to him as a king, although, of course, he's not a king yet. But that's what they say. And David feels the pressure of that. In fact, it's the only time in the books of Samuel that we read that David is actually afraid. It says that David took this to heart and he was actually afraid. Very much afraid. We read something about that in Psalm 56, which is also connected with this time. Psalm 56 and Psalm 34 are written around about this time. And in one of the verses there, verse 6, David says, "They conspire, they lurk, they watch my steps, hoping to take my life." So here he is, and he's in the town, and he sees that people are watching him. He hears that they've recognized him. And I think at some point he is seized by them, because it talks about sort of taking him to hand. He's arrested. He's interrogated. He's in their hands, verse 13. And Psalm 56 also talks about him being seized by the Philistines. So they're watching him. They seize him. And he can't think what to do, so he pretends madness. Seems to be a reasonable actor. Maybe he's had practice of madness in observing Saul, but he pretends pretty well to be crazy. And you know, there's that kind of cheesy sticker. You don't have to be mad to work around here, but it helps, which some offices and so forth have, or other places. That seems to be the motto for Achish. And he says, rather amusingly, "I think I've got enough crazy people here as it is. I don't want another one." So David manages to escape because of that. See that in chapter 22, verse 1. David left Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. On the surface, David's running scared. He's desperate. He's using all the tricks he can find to stay alive. But if you look at the Psalms that he wrote at this time, Psalm 34, Psalm 56, it's clear that he's not trusting himself. He's not saying, "Wow, I'm really resourceful. I'm such a cool actor." He's not saying that. He's not saying, "Oh, I managed to hoodwink the Philistines." He's consciously, intentionally praising the Lord. He's boasting in the Lord. Surely, If he was going to boast at any time, it would be after all he'd done with the giant Goliath and now his great resourcefulness in managing to escape from the Philistines by acting. But he wants to say really clearly, my boast is in the Lord. Think about the greatest works of art or the greatest songs that have been written. I reckon all the great ones are written out of agony. You find that with kind of popular songwriters, that they kind of write their best stuff when they're going through some kind of personal trauma. You have to be of a certain age to know this, but you think about the song Layla from Eric Clapton, and some people are nodding of a certain age, and such a great song, one of those classic songs written out of the anguish of, I think it's George Harrison's wife or something. Either they were having an affair or they weren't having an affair or something was happening to do with her, and Layla was the kind of code name for her and the source of writing that song. And I'm sure loads of other popular songs are written out of anguish. And when people kind of get into stable, loving relationships, it's a bit harder to write with the same kind of angst and the same kind of edge. David produces outstanding poetry from this time. Psalm 34 is a clever psalm in all sorts of ways. Each verse begins with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. But apart from the cleverness and the structure and the poetry, think about the words that are written in that psalm. And it really shows us that when we're struggling, that's the time when faith is either shattered or it really shines. Think about what David says. We read it earlier on in the meeting, the whole of the psalm, Psalm 34, and it's a great psalm to go away and read later for yourselves. But verse 4, he says, I sought the Lord, and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears. What was David doing in this section in 1 Samuel 21? He's fearing. In fact, the only time that it's described that he's fearing. He's fearing. And what's he delivered from? Not first of all from the events, but from his fears. He's learning to trust the Lord. I sought the Lord. Where did I go when I'm stuck here in Gath and they're seizing me and I don't know what to do? Where do I go? I go to the Lord. And then verse 6, this poor man called and the Lord heard him. He saved him out of all his troubles. He's assured that God hears him. There's a great line in Psalm 56, verse 8, where it says that he's stored my tears in a bottle. It might mean that he's written them down, but one translation is that he's stored up my tears in a bottle. What an amazing thought. Do you remember, is it the BFG that stores up dreams in a kind of bottle, something like that, and does something with them, distributes them somewhere or something like that? It's just such a great image, isn't it, that God stores up our tears in a bottle. Have you cried? Have you cried? Well, whether it's a bottle or whether it's a record, God knows. God knows that you cried. God knows your tears. God knows all about your trouble. And as a poor man, as a poor woman, you call out to God. He hears and he answers. This is such a severe test of David's faith, and his fear needs to be flushed away. And the only way that will happen is if he prays and if he acknowledges that God's in charge. If he acknowledges and says, yeah, God knows all about me. God knows all about my troubles. I really believe that. In my desperation, I believe that. And then in that wonderful way, he has that expression, taste and see that the Lord is good. In my trouble, I really experienced that God was good. It wasn't just a distant smell to me. It wasn't just something that I observed with my eyes. Now, through this trouble, this is something I tasted. This is something I really experienced, that God is a good and faithful God and he hears my prayers. God knows all about us. We need to know him. And in a wonderful way, through trials, when people seem to be abandoning us, when we seem to have run out of ideas, when we fear, whatever it is we fear, That's the time when God is real to us and our faith is proved and improved. And in a wonderful way, we become good news tellers. Psalm 34 again, verses 8 through 11. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. Fear the Lord, you his holy people, for those who fear him lack nothing. The lions may grow weak and hungry, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. Come, my children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. You know what's great about that? He says, I went through all these troubles, and the Lord delivered me, and I want to tell you all about it. Come on, listen to me. Listen to me tell you about my experiences. Not my experiences of how good I was. I don't want to tell you about how I was really clever and did this acting thing. I want to tell you that God answered my prayers. You know, the best advert, the best gospel tellers are people who have experienced the gospel and who want to share it with others. Not to share their greatness, not to share their achievements, but to share their experience of the mercy of God. You can all do that. You can tell your children, you can tell your friends, you can tell your workmates, you can tell your school friends, you can tell your parents, you can tell your children. You can experience that too. I asked the Lord to save me in the first place, and he heard me, and he delivered me. And I've asked the Lord for many things, and he's always answered graciously. Let me tell you about it. Let me tell you what it is to fear the Lord. We can all do that. Because people who've been proved in trials are able to tell of their experiences of the goodness of God. We were thinking about that a bit yesterday in one of the discussions at the Associate Gospel Partnership conference. Somebody was mentioning, I think a couple of people had mentioned, how because of particular trials that they'd been through, they felt much more kind of liberated to say a gospel word to somebody. Not to boast about their trials, not to boast about their achievements, but it kind of released them because the trials had been so severe and so kind of trying that it released them to tell. But you can do that. All of us Christians here this morning have a story to tell. We may not have had great deliverances in life yet, but we've had the greatest deliverance of all as Christ has forgiven our sins in dying on the cross and rising again. We've all got that story to tell. That we've all got a story to say, this poor man, this poor woman called, and the Lord delivered me from my fundamental trouble, my sin, the pit that I was in. We've all got that story to tell. You might have better write great poetry. You might not be a great king, but you can say, come, my children, listen to me, and I will try and teach you the fear of the Lord from my experience. That's what Jesus does, isn't it? There's an expression in this Psalm 34 that says, not one of his bones will be broken. And of course, it's a promise really for the general preservation of the Lord's anointed David. But it has a particular fulfillment in Jesus, that as he hangs on the cross, he dies quickly. So his legs are not broken in order to speed up his death. And so, in that sense, he's kind of preserved as a perfect sacrifice. In the Old Testament, the sacrificial lambs were to be without any leg breaks and so forth. So he's a perfect sacrifice there. So it connects with that, but also with Jesus' experience that he goes through all that suffering and death in order that he may declare the praises of God. You know, on the cross, he quotes from Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some people think perhaps he works through the Psalms and ends up in Psalm 31 that has the words, into your hands I commit my spirit, which Jesus does say on the cross. It made me think about this. If Jesus really was working through those Psalms, is Jesus praising God on the cross? Is Jesus praising God on the cross? I think he is. I think in the most severe trial that could ever be imagined, Jesus is pouring out his complaint as the words of Psalm 22 are, but at the same time, He's praising God in his trials. He's declaring the praises of God in his trials. That's a wonderful thing to think about to do with Jesus. That's a wonderful example for us in our trials, in the crosses that we bear, wanting to declare the praises of God into the congregation. So the Lord hears the prayer of his anointed one, David. He changes his fear to faith. And so David is able to sing songs of deliverance, a great model for us. Finally, the Lord calls people to serve with his anointed king. Let's read the first few verses of chapter 22. David left Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. When his brothers and his father's household heard about it, they went down to him there. All those who were in distress or in debt or discontented gathered around him, and he became their leader. About 400 men were with him. From there, David went to Mizpah in Moab and said to the king of Moab, "Would you let my father and mother come to stay with you until I learn what God will do for me?" So he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed there as long as David was in the stronghold. But the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Go into the land of Judah." So David left and went to the forest of Hereth. David escapes to a cave, or it might be the word for a fortress. Maybe it's a fortified cave. And his family join him there, along with all those who are distressed, in debt, or discontented. He then takes his family to Moab, which is not so strange as it would sound, because, of course, his great-grandmother is who? Who's David's great-grandmother? Ruth, who was a Moabitess. So maybe he still has connections there, so he takes his family there to keep them safe. What is really great is that David now seems to be talking in theological terms, and he's hearing from God. So see verse 3. "Would you let my father and mother come to stay with you until I learn what God will do for me?" He really has had answered prayer, hasn't he? A real sense that God is with him. So he's now expressing that God has plans for him and that he trusts those plans, and he's waiting to see what God wants him to do next. And also see verse 5. "The prophet Gad said to David," where did he come from? But suddenly, God is speaking to David. "The prophet Gad said to David, 'Do not stay in the stronghold,'" and so on. So God's word is coming into David's life, and he believes and trusts in God's providence. He sees where he is as a bit of a refuge, but a bit of a prison. See that in Psalm 142, again written around this time. "Set me free from my prison that I may praise your name. Then the righteous will gather about me because of your goodness to me." Another psalm written when he's in the cave, Psalm 57. "Have mercy on me, my God, have mercy on me, for in you I take refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed." It is a place of safety, but his refuge is not in the cave. In a way, he feels the cave to be a prison. His refuge now, he knows, is in God, not in the fortifications. And as he's there in his humiliation, really, as kind of hiding like a fox in a hole, as he's there in his humiliation, people come and join him, those who are in debt or distressed or discontented. That's such a great picture of the church, isn't it? Jesus, in John's Gospel, we hear, talks a number of times about him being lifted up on the cross. And in John 12, he says, "As the Son of Man is lifted up onto the cross, he will draw all men to himself." Think about Jesus in the darkness as he dies. As he's praising God, even in the darkness, even in the abandonment, as he's praising God, we're drawn to that. We're drawn to be one of his people. I love that description of them. The people that went around to David, they're in distress or in debt or discontented. Are you any or all of those things? Distressed or in debt or discontented? You can't go and join David at the cave, but you can go and join Jesus at the cross. Are you feeling distressed this morning? Perhaps you've never actually come to the cross. Perhaps you haven't joined Jesus. Are you feeling distressed, borne, weighed down by trials? Are you feeling in debt? Maybe you're literally in debt, but maybe you're also feeling the debt of sin that you owe God, that you owe God a debt that you can never pay and it needs to be forgiven. Are you finding this life is not enough? You're discontented. It's not filling up. It's not completing you. It's not satisfying you. You know that. This morning is a great time to like these guys came to join David. You come and join Jesus and say, I come to the cross. I come to the place of your humiliation and I want to be with you at the cross. And I want to have my sins forgiven. I'm discontented. I'm in debt. I'm distressed. I'm a sinful man. I'm a lost man, but I come to the cross and I want to be part of your party. I want you to be my king. I want you to be my rescuer. It's a humbling thing to come to where you are, but I want to come to where you are at the cross and be forgiven. Do you want to do that this morning? Do you want to come to Jesus and be part of his band, be part of his party? Because just like David eventually springs out of the cave, but also eventually is crowned King of Kings and Lord of Lords, so is Jesus, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And although the cross is a mystery, and although the cross is a humbling thing to talk about and to think about, Jesus is victorious and he is the true King. Where would you rather be? You know, most of us would rather be with Saul because we're not thinking this is a doomed kingdom. We're thinking this is pretty relaxed. This is not a problem. But when we're thinking straight, we think, I'd rather be with David ultimately because he's the true king and he's got God with him. Where do you want to be this morning? With the true king or with the counterfeit king? Where are you? It's a great section. God's with his anointed. The bread of the presence is a symbol of that. God hears the prayer of his anointed, and David wants to sing about that. Do you want to sing about the goodness of God to you? Do you want to follow the example of David in that? Follow the example of Christ. And the Lord, not David, but Jesus, calls you to join his band. Do you want to join this morning?